Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. Richard Jackson. He's a board-certified neurologist with the Ellis Neuroscience Center in Schenectady in Clifton Park. He provides neurological treatment for patients and specializes in treatment of migraines and concussions. Dr. Jackson earned his medical degree from Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He completed his residency at New York University. He comes from a family of neurologists, and he was formerly a semi-pro soccer player in Brazil. Whoa! Got a question for Dr. Jackson? The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a very popular program, and a lot of people have headaches. A lot of people will have questions. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Jackson, let me start by, first of all, welcoming you, and second of all, saying, why do people get headaches?
That's an excellent question. If I knew the answer to that, I probably wouldn't be practicing, right? I'd be living in the Bahamas or something like that, right? But there's a lot of different reasons for that. Migraine is thought to be a genetic etiology, right?
Is that right?
So, yeah, it's thought to be something passed down from parents to kids or something like that. And anybody who has a family history of migraine will tell you that mom had headaches, I have headaches, or the kid has headaches. Every once in a while, you hear somebody who says, "Well, my parents didn't have it, and they come in with a headache." And you ask, say, "Well, which of your parents had it, or does your brothers or sisters or somebody has it?" And they say, "Well, no, but my daughter has it, or my son has it." So you can see there's a very clear, like, genetic predisposition towards this particular headache kind of manifestation.
So if you have a headache, what's the best remedy for it that you can do? In other words, you get it?
It depends on how bad your headaches are. I mean, the best remedy is whatever works, right? Because headache is a pain syndrome. It very infrequently kind of heralds the onset of something more serious, right? The thing everybody worries about is tumor, right? You have a headache, you know, that's the one. Even people who have had headaches for 30 years, you know, they come to me and they say, "Hey, look, do you think we should just get an MRI just to see if I've developed a tumor in the past year," right? Even though they've had previous ones. Because that's everybody's biggest fear. But, you know, it's only even when you look at like tumor characteristics and the patient's symptoms, only like 50% of people with brain tumors have actual headaches as the cardinal manifestation, and less than 1% of all headaches ever have anything show up on MRI. So it's
less
very
than 1%.
Low. Less than
1%. Okay, out there, let's remember that.
Yeah, so most often headaches are just headaches. They're just painful. But, you know, pain can really ruin your life, right? If you have headaches every single day, it can get in the way of job, work, social life, taking care of your kids. And that's the reason there's so much treatment surrounding it, is because it can be such a problem in people's personal lives.
I read somewhere that an ex-president claimed that if he had sex, he would not have migraines. He would not have headaches. You think there's anything to that?
I don't know. Sometimes you can have orgasmic migraine, right? So you can have a headache at the onset of orgasm, right?
Oh,
so,
is that right?
Yeah. So you never know. Yeah. So
see, I'm glad you're here, because I would never have known that. Okay, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, real quick, what do you got?
How important is magnesium in the prevention and treatment of migraines, and which form is most beneficial?
That's a good question, right? It really depends on whether it works for you or not, right? So if you look at the textbook of migraine and headache medicine in general, it's called Wolf's Headache. This is an old textbook, has been revised multiple times, and it goes through most of the actual statistics as to whether these things work or not, right? There's actually better research done on riboflavin, you know, but most of these things are kind of prescribed together, right? So most of the time, if you're going to try and treat a headache or migraines with magnesium and riboflavin, then most of the time they're prescribed together, but sometimes individually. So you really have to look at what the goal of treatment is, right? So when you take one of these daily medicines like magnesium or riboflavin or Topamax or any of these things, the goal is to decrease your headache frequency by 50%, right? So that's the importance of it to you, right? So if somebody gave you magnesium, the importance is to you, if it's working, if you have headaches 7 days a week, it should decrease it to about 3 or 4 days a week. So there's never been any studies that I know of that show that migraine or headaches is a specific deficiency in magnesium, but it's a smooth muscle relaxer, and it's used in OBGYN for people with preeclampsia and things like that. And so the thought is that it's that migraine is a vascular disorder, and that by giving magnesium, you kind of relax the muscles, but nobody really knows for certain. So the importance of it to anyone, to you, is whether it works or not. If it doesn't work for you, doesn't mean it won't work for somebody else. That's the individualized treatment of headache and migraine.
Jim, thank you very much. Okay, we'll go to Dan in the Pioneer Valley. Dan, you're on.
Hi, this is kind of the other end of the nervous system. I'm calling about lower back pain that I have. I've got an orthopedic surgeon, neurosurgeon, and basically cut to the chase. I'm wondering, is there anything for nerve inflammation that you know about, diet or things that are non-surgical, non-narcotic ways of reducing those nerve inflammations coming out of the facet joints of your kind of lower back?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not familiar with any specific diets or any of that type, any of those types of more naturalistic. I would kind of be the wrong person to talk to about that. There are people out there that know more about naturalistic herbal remedies, those types of things. Alan and I were just talking about this. A lot of times, the best treatment for some of these things is just exercise, right? The medicines are all really designed to help you be more mobile, more functional, right? So there are no cures for any of this stuff, right? Once you develop facet disease or a herniated disc or something, there's nothing, even surgery, that can really cure that, right? The surgery kind of fixes the picture a little bit, but it doesn't, there's lots of things, pain generators that show up on, that are in real life that don't show up on MRI. So like facet disease doesn't usually show up on MRI, but if the pain guys put a needle in there and put some lidocaine and block it, then you feel relief, then it was the facet, right? So a lot of this stuff is just designed to help people get more mobile, and you really have to figure out what the pain generator is, right? Is it the muscle? Is it the ligament? Is it the bone? Is it the joint? Is it a disc? Is it the root, right? And a lot of the treatment is really centered on which one of those is your problem, and really probably only your doctors and the people who are examining you probably know. So, as you can see, it becomes much more complex problem than just being able to say, well, this diet will reduce inflammation, because a diet may reduce inflammation, but it may not help you, right?
So have you been doing core exercises, Dan?
Yes, yoga and different core strengthening exercises, but it still comes and goes.
And that's actually pretty good, right? If you have pain that only comes and goes, and if you have bad disease and you have a neurosurgeon and orthopedic surgeon, pain that comes and goes is better than, continuous chronic pain. So,
of course.
Yeah. So, I'm sure that I would, just a word of caution, be careful what's on the internet, right? When you buy these things and when you start looking up natural remedies, right? So when people come to me in the clinic and they say, hey, look, what do you think about this? I always tell them, well, look, if you can afford it and it works for you, then maybe you should try it, right? But be very careful of these expensive diets and fad things. We've kind of all been around long enough to see these things come and go. And just be careful what you spend on it, right?
Of course.
Dan, gotta let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. And we'll go to Alan in Woodstock. Whoa. Alan in Woodstock, you're on.
Hi. I'm 67 years old. Since my 20s or 30s, I've had scintillating scotomas a couple of times a year. They've become more frequent in the last 5 or 10 years. Usually they go away in an hour or two, no big deal. However, the last one I had a few weeks ago was accompanied by a period of aphasia for about 20 or 30 minutes. I really couldn't read or speak very clearly. And I'm just wondering if that's something new or is that part of this syndrome?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It can be, right? So, you know, the...
Can you explain to all of us, Doc, what they are?
So, what he's talking about with the scintillating scotoma is the bright flashing lights that people describe, right? Sometimes it can be, like, little starbursts or, like, what they call the fortification spectra, which is, you know, jagged lines, kind of looks like a wall or something like that, and it kind of builds over time. You know, and it's interesting because... they studied this, I think, in the 90s, and they thought that maybe if they block that particular phenomenon from coming, that they could cure migraine, right? So they had this, you know, compound with a bunch of letters and numbers, and, you know, it was basically an anticonvulsant, anti-epileptic drug, and they gave it to people, and they blocked the scintillating scotoma from forming, but it didn't stop the headache from coming, right? Indicating there's two different things happening, right? So when you have the scotoma, it's... They've shown it on, you know, blood, like blood metabolism MRIs, to be a blood flow problem in the posterior part of the brain that spreads forward, not dangerous, right? And you can have things like complicated neurologic symptoms like, you know, aphasia or a little bit of weakness. And sometimes those things actually turn out to be like genetic predispositions. You have what's called a channelopathy or something like that, meaning you have an actual nerve-related problem. Most of the time they turn out not to be anything bad. Now, what I would caution in your case is attributing it to something benign because you're of the age you can start to have neurodegenerative blood disorders like high blood pressure, diabetes, right? So anybody who hears that coming from you is first going to think TIA and then think migraine, right? So
yeah, that's what my doctor thought. He wanted to rule out TIA.
Right, you have to, right?
Because you explain what a TIA is.
So TIA,
we gotta go soon.
Okay, so TIA basically is when you have a stroke-like symptom, right? You have a clogging of a blood vessel, but it resolves and it doesn't leave any scar on the MRI, right? So you can get totally better and have a scar on your MRI, and that's technically a stroke, right? Because it left a little scar or damage, right? But and so the difficulty in your specific case is that the MRI was probably normal and you had this strange event, right? So the difficulty, is that TIA? Is that migraine? Was it a migrainous type event, right? And really, I have no idea about your whole case, right?
Yeah.
The only way to get to the bottom of that is you got to talk to your treating physician and say, hey, look, what does this look like?
All right,
and all that
great.
Type of stuff.
Alan,
all right.
I'm so sorry. We got to go. Thanks a lot.
That's
right,
I appreciate it. Thank
no
you.
No problem.
Okay, we're about to take a very short break. A couple of seconds. We'll be right back. We'll talk to Gene and Wendy and Joe and others.
Support comes from the Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, offering urologic oncology services with prostate specialists using active monitoring protocols designed to help avoid or postpone cancer treatments. UrologyOncology.com. Northeast Solar in Hatfield, Massachusetts, helping Pioneer Valley residents live more sustainably with solar power for home, business, or farm. Keep solar local. Northeast-solar.com. And from Nathan Latour Hospital, proudly introducing the gastroenterology specialist of Latour with Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Ramani, and Dr. Rahman, NLH.org. And from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. And from the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. We are here with Dr. Jackson, and I got to tell you, Richard Jackson is a brilliant man, board-certified neurologist with the Ellis Neuroscience Center in Schenectady in Clifton Park. Neurological treatment for patients and specialized in treatment of migraines and concussions. And we'll go to Gene in New Paltz. Hi, Gene. You're on.
Hi. I'm 68 years old. I've had migraines since I was in kindergarten. And I've had two TIAs. At least that's what the doctors thought it was. I don't know how you prove that or whatever, but I guess from what happened, that's what he assumed. I had a carotid artery test. I don't know, and I guess whatever that at the time because of it. I used to take stuff that I think was probably for sinus headaches as well when I was younger, like during my childbearing years, Phiagesic, Ygesic, codeine. But then they got worse during perimenopause, which I went through menopause at age 39. And then afterwards, they were much worse. So about a dozen years ago, I took Topamax for about 5 years, and it didn't really stop the visual disturbances. And at that time, they were still accompanied with pain. Now, I don't take Topamax. I have visual disturbances. I guess they call them occipital migraines. But I don't really have pain, like headache pain.
Well, you're very lucky.
There's certain things that happen that I eat or do that cause them. Bananas. Now, I'm a child of the 60s. I went to college in the 60s. Do those little strips, those little strings on the side of bananas cause headaches?
I have no idea. But what I would say is if they cause it in you, then yeah, possibly.
Okay, and I switched to organic bananas. I've switched almost all of my food to organic, and I think that's helped, I hope. You know, I mean, I have less pain now.
That's great. There's so much in your story, right? So it sounds like, you know, there were, you know, possibly hormone triggered, which is a common, you know, migraine phenomenon.
I was also the recipient of someone else's kidney surgery by mistake at a hospital when I was 18, and that's when the migraines got really bad.
What do you mean by mistake?
They did somebody else's surgery on me. And so I was on prednisone for many years to correct whatever they did to me.
Huh.
Okay, we got to get an answer here. I will get a letter saying you should have let her go on longer, but there are five people behind you. And so,
do you have a specific question, Gene? There's a lot of stuff in what's been happening to you. You have a very long medical history.
Well, just one other thing.
Sure.
Light does it. Light.
Yeah.
There's a flash of light.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can be in bright light if it's constant and surrounds my whole being, but if a light goes off or gets turned on, that's when it happens.
Yeah, so what I'll say, just kind of sum up your some of the things you said, right? So the goal of Topamax, much like we talked about with magnesium and riboflavin, is to decrease your attacks by 50%. That's what the medication is designed to do. It's an off-label use. It's designed for that, right? So it's not going to eliminate the visual phenomena that you have. It's just meant to decrease the pain that you have, right? And so kind of like I said earlier, is that the pain and the visual phenomenon are related but not necessarily connected, because you can get rid of the visual phenomenon and do nothing to the pain. So the reason for trying the Topamax is to decrease the frequency of pain that you have. So it has nothing to do with whether or not it's going to actually affect the visual phenomena. And then, so if that's something to discuss with your doctor, whether or not you need to be on that. So if you don't have any migraines or pain anymore and you just have the visual phenomena, that's terrific, right? Because it's usually the pain that really causes problems. The one caveat to that is if you have large visual problems from the scotoma or something, it can be a problem with driving. So just be careful of that.
And what's the scotoma?
The scotoma is either an enlarging, like, dark spot in your vision, or it's usually the bright lights that you see.
Okay, it's like an arc, like on a clock, like from maybe 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock if you were looking at it.
Yeah, that type of stuff.
Okay, Gene, we're going to have to let you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Wendy in Alford, Massachusetts. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. I had a concussion 2 years ago, and the lasting effect is double vision. And my ophthalmologist has suggested vision therapy.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, you almost have to, right? So there's a couple of different things that can happen with concussion. You can have convergence insufficiency, where you have problems, you know, looking towards your nose, or you have, you know, the opposite problem where they kind of relax too far. You have problems looking in the distance. You have problems looking left and right. You know, have problems with tracking. And really, there are specialized guys like neurooptometrists that give you special exercises, like with blue lights and practice and things like that.
Right.
And really, that problem doesn't seem to get better unless you do those exercises.
And what are the exercises?
You know, I don't really know, actually, to tell you the truth.
Wendy,
I know it's a lot of eye tracking and movement practicing and things like that, but people seem to get better, and that's kind of the only treatment for what you have, because it's a non-surgical problem. And nobody really knows what the eye movement problems are with concussion, whether it's from the brain tissue itself, whether it's the nerves that connect the brain to the eyes, but the treatments are kind of the same. So,
that's good to hear, because I'm going to start it. It has affected my ability to drive long distances.
Yeah, it will. The exercise is going to make you tired. That's a good sign.
We're going to go, Wendy.
Okay.
All right, Wendy.
It's actually in Holyoke or Northampton.
Whoa,
Mass.
that's a little bit of a drive for you.
Well, yes, it is, but it's the only location in Mass that's somewhat close to the Berkshire.
Thanks, Wendy. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, we'll go to Joe in Olive Bridge. Joe in Olive Bridge, you're on.
Yeah, I had a concussion also a couple of years ago, and I thought it was a fairly minor concussion, and there were some lasting effects that had to do with fatigue, especially, that would come and go, some blurry vision, and various symptoms that would come and go at different times. So I'm curious what the current ideas are for dealing with post-concussion syndrome, as it's labeled. And, you know, anything else I might do about that, even though it's a lot better than it was, it's still in the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common problem. Tell me a little bit about the treatment you had for the concussion when you first had it. Did you have exertional testing, like any kind of treadmill testing or anything like that?
I didn't really have much treatment at all, to be honest. I went to a couple of neurologists who told me I was fine.
Sure.
And I just had to wait it out.
Yeah, and that's kind of the old approach to doing it, the tincture of time treatment, right? You're going to get better as you go. I don't know if you heard the last caller talking about the eye movement abnormalities. You know, that's kind of one of those things. Some of these things tend to get better over time all by themselves, and some of them don't. So the real question, you know, is still out there is, what is the post-concussive syndrome, right? Is it a persistent cognitive problem? Is it the body's response to dealing with the new problem and the adaptation in your normal life to it? So it really depends on when you're having fatigue. Is it like body fatigue? Is it mental fatigue? Tell me a little bit about that.
Hey, Joe, you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The question one more time, please.
Yeah, go ahead.
So what I said was, tell me a little bit about when the symptoms come on.
Well, for instance, I found that a couple times they came on at high altitudes. I found that the issue with blurry vision is completely unpredictable, and it's usually only when I'm reading, and it's easy enough to slough it off to getting older.
Yeah, sure.
But the way that it comes and goes is
strange,
quite
right?
Unpredictable.
So that's kind of like what I was saying to the last caller, is you should probably have an evaluation either by neurooptometry or neuro-ophthalmology to see if you have convergence insufficiency, right? That's basically trying to look at your nose, and that's a common concussion-type symptom, and maybe one that might not have gotten better with you, or you could have had a convergence insufficient or maybe developing one. It's hard to say what it actually is. You have to really get checked out and have somebody diagnose and see what's going on. But if that's bothering you, then that's the route I would head for that, probably, is to pick one symptom at a time. And the fatigue is kind of one of these very nonspecific things, but I'll give you an example. If you're working at something, and it doesn't have to be concussion-related. Like, let's say you're in high school and trying to learn Spanish, you're going to be much more fatigued after that intensive episode than if you, let's say, in something in English. And so if you're trying to do something cognitively taxing, one thing I've just kind of noticed anecdotally is that afterwards people seem to be much more fatigued, right? So if you're doing something that's going to tax your nervous system, like you're trying to read and your eyes are continuing trying to focus, it might bring on the fatigue or tiredness afterwards. So if those are your two symptoms, I wouldn't chase after the fatigue so much as I would go after the eye movement abnormalities and maybe try and see a neuro-ophthalmologist or neuro-optometrist.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. Over the internet, we heard from Rosalind, who said, as an ex-soccer player, can Dr. Jackson speak to the problem with concussions as they relate to soccer? I have two granddaughters and a son who all play soccer. I always thought soccer was one of the better games for not having a concussion, sort of like, unlike football.
Yeah, girls' soccer is particularly high in concussion rates, actually.
Really?
Yeah, nobody knows why that is. They think maybe, you know, neck strength or something, or aggression. Nobody really knows.
And you bounce the ball over your head on your head.
Yeah, the concussion is really related to the force of the impact and the direction it happens to you, right? So people can have it from car accidents, getting hit in the back. You can kind of get sideswiped during a soccer game or football or something. And so it's really variable as to how these things happen. And, you know, sometimes it can happen in the same way and you don't really have any cognitive effects. Me personally, I know I've had concussions before, but the old treatment was kind of, well, do you know where you are? Okay, get back in the game, right?
And so what is a concussion again?
So concussion is really just this kind of overarching broad term for a minor brain injury, right? It's not head injury per se, because head kind of denotes that, well, you have soft tissue or a skull fracture or something. The idea is that your brain actually moved inside your skull, right? So it's inertia forces kind of playing a part in it. So you were stopped and the brain kept going, that type of thing. And the one of the thoughts is that you have very specific areas where things, either trauma or inflammation or, you know, different types of enzymes and proteins and hormones from the blood get access to the brain where they wouldn't normally, right? So it's a change in functioning after trauma is basically what it is. And so one of the new things that just happened was, in response to litigation, right, they just kind of, the U.S. Soccer Federation just said that, well, anyone under 12 is not going to be heading the ball anymore, which I think is probably a step in the right direction, but it's not really the heading the ball that causes it. It's the impact at high velocities or the impact of two people together. So, you know, this is, there's much more work to be done on this, and this is just kind of starting. I think probably whipping the ball in from the sides at high velocities and have people slam their head into it when their neck muscles aren't developed and things like that, that's probably dangerous. Or having two people go up together, I think those are going to be the parts of soccer that are going to be looked at more closely as opposed to just heading the ball. But without a doubt, concussion is a much under-recognized problem than it used to be in all sports, and soccer included. It's just kind of coming to light in the NFL and football.
Thank you. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Hi, Joanna.
Hi there. I've actually thought of a second topic, so I'll throw two quick ones out on you, and you can comment on either.
Sure.
One is, if you have any thoughts on acute episodes of post-shingles pain, not eruption of the shingles blisters at all, but acute pain in the area of the shingles. This is 6 years out. And the second one is, if you have any experience with treating nocturia as a result of multiple concussions from competitive sports. This is in an 80-year-old. I have heard that repeat concussions can do something to the hormone that causes urine concentrating at night.
It can. I'll take the first one first. So most of the treatment surrounding, you know, treatment of pain and shingles is just based on symptomatic treatment, right? Just trying to decrease the pain. You know, Tegretol or carbamazepine is one of the, you know, first-line treatments. I can't remember who it was, but there was a Grand Rounds when I was at NYU, and there was a guy who proposed that sometimes people can actually find evidence in the blood of the virus recirculating, and that sometimes repeating the treatment with, you know, with one of the antivirals can actually help with that. Now, me personally, I have not found that in a single patient I've looked for, but it is the possibility, especially if somebody keeps having reactivation of the exact same thing. That's an extremely controversial topic, I'm sure. Most people would just say, well, it's just the pain coming back or breaking through, and you just need to control it a little better. So those are kind of, at least the last time I looked into that topic, those are what I found. As far as
those two drugs, Integritol and carbamazepine,
those are the ones most commonly used to treat the postherpetic zoster type pain. Okay. Those just kind of cover up the pain, but they work really well.
And on a similar question, Joanna, if I can just cut in here, and that is, should we be getting the shots?
Actually, my this person I'm talking about here had not gotten a shingles shot when they got the shingles the first time, and has subsequently, within the last year, the doctor recommended her getting a shingles shot.
Okay, so our neurologist would say, get the shingles shot or not?
I think most people would argue that vaccines are a good idea, and I'm sure whoever it is you're taking care of would agree that what she's going through is not fun.
Yeah, so it's worth doing it, although I understand it doesn't work always.
Correct.
By any means.
Like anything.
Yeah, I asked my doc whether he took a shot. He said no. He said, me neither. Okay, so Joanna, what was the second one we want?
Do you have any experience with treating people with nocturia from concussions, particularly about this hormone for concentrating the urine at night?
That can. That's certainly a possibility, right? I'm sure they're talking about SIADH. It really depends on how long ago the head traumas were and when you developed it. There are pretty specific guidelines on how to diagnose that condition.
So what is it? Most of us have never heard of this.
Yeah,
before.
It's one of these things that mainly happens with head injuries, and the neurosurgeons are most familiar with
but
this
what
because
is it?
They see a lot of head injuries. Oh, it's the anti-diuretic hormone, basically. So diuretic means that you urinate, right? So when the anti-diuretic hormone kind of keeps you from urinating as much as you should, right? So you build up kind of water in your system.
Is that good or bad?
It's bad. It's a syndrome, right? It's treatable, right? It doesn't sound maybe like that's what you're talking about. And especially in an 80-year-old woman, it's more likely to be something else than that.
Well, I guess I've tried everything else, so I'm wondering if that could possibly be it.
Yeah, it's worth checking into. Yeah.
Joanna, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a very short break. We'll be back. We'll talk to Eric and Martin and Brian and Susan, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York, locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating. ApexSolarPower.com for information. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, custom-designed, panelized house kits featuring eco-friendly, passive, and solar design elements. Noble-home.net. Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. Antrim, HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams, weekends February 12th through 28th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org.
And here we are with Dr. Jackson, Richard Jackson, board-certified neurologist, the Ellis Neuroscience Center in Schenectady in Clifton Park. Okay, so Dr. Jackson, let's go to the phones. Now, folks, we only have, you know, about 18, 19 minutes here, so keep them short. We'll give you short answers, okay? Here we go. Eric in Rhinebeck. Eric, you're on.
Hello, Alan. And, Doctor, you mentioned orgasm onset migraines.
Sure.
I get those, and I'm periodically, and I'm wondering if there's any known cause, prevention, treatment.
Yeah, there's pretty good prevention, actually. Of course, I'm not allowed to like prescribe or say anything about it, but that's one of those common problems that you run into, and you should just see a neurologist probably for that, because I don't know your past medical history, and I can't say anything over the phone, but there are treatments for that. The cause still up in the air, like most things in migraine, right?
Well, one treatment would be no sex.
Nobody really goes for that one. That's what I prescribed for a while.
Right. Everybody tries that one, right? But everybody wants something else that's more mainstream than that.
Eric, thanks for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Martin. I messed up. We went to Brian. We'll do Martin next. Brian, you're on.
I am on, and up to the age of 17, I suffered from incredible migraine headaches about every 5 or 6 weeks. I would get a full day of aura, exploding lights in my head, and not focusing. And I would have to go home. This would be throughout junior high school and high school. And the only thing that I could do to relieve it would be to go into a pitch black room and wrap ice cold wet towels as a tourniquet around my brain to hold it from exploding. And after 2-3 days, it would start to diminish, and then it would be gone, and then I'd have to wait till the next one. That went on sporadically till I was 17, 18 years old, went away to college, and I would have to say that they most assuredly tended to dissipate after that. After 9/11, we lived all the way downtown, and the trauma of it all caused my migraines to come back, and I chose to go into a course of EMDR. And I did that for 2 weeks, and that was like the miracle for me because I haven't had one since then, and I would say
okay,
that that's
stop,
been
stop,
a solid
stop, stop.
Years.
They say, Brian, stop. What's EMDR?
EMDR is a rapid eye movement therapy
okay.
where you sit in a chair and the therapist moves either a finger or an object, a pencil or some type of a baton in front of your eyes, and you start off very, 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 very slow and just watch it as hard and as fast as you can or as slow as you can. And then you continue to watch it as the speed accelerates to the point where you can't do it anymore and you have to finally shut your eyes and stop and then calm down after 10 or 15 minutes. And then you would wait 2 or 3 days. Then you'd go through the whole process again. And I do believe it was called EMDR.
Sure.
I could be wrong.
Okay, well, wait a second now. Doctor?
Yeah, so you're very lucky that they went away, right? I mean, this happens, you know, in various people. There was a new paper that came out in one of the migraine or headache journals that said that was questioning whether chronic migraine was due to partially or inadequately treated intermittent migraine, basically. So yours kind of went away, and you didn't really have to worry about it, which can happen, right? And the question is what caused all that? Was it traumatic? Was it hormonal? You know, you should just kind of thank your lucky stars that it went away, right? Because it can be a really disabling problem. As to why it came back again, it could be a myriad of things, right? If you were downtown in the middle of it, at NYU, they started a World Trade Center headache clinic, right? It could have been like dust particle related. It could have been stress related. It could have been neck pain related. It could be a host of everything else. But if all you had to do was the EMDR treatment, I mean, that's terrific. You can't say that for everybody, right? Because everybody's headache treatments are individualized, but that's terrific for you.
Martin, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much. Let's go to Brian in Beacon. Brian in Beacon, you're on. Brian? No? Is he there? He's not there? Brian's hung up, yes? What are you trying to tell me? Okay, let's see. Who's on now? Is this Martin?
Yes.
Okay, Martin. Oh, I'm so sorry. That was my fault, as pointed out by our wonderful volunteer. Okay, go ahead, Martin.
Thank you, Alan and doctors. I had a craniotomy 2 years ago with continuing headaches, which I can't seem to get rid of. But my question is, I've been to the hospital a couple of times when the headaches got really bad to see if I was bleeding again, but they say no. Could craniotomy lead to tumors?
I mean, you can never say never in medicine, right? Because when you're cutting through bone tissue, muscle, right? But somewhere along the line, if you've been to these emergency rooms, they would have done a CAT scan of your head, right? And they would have seen something. What I will tell you is that a very common problem after craniotomy is the muscle they have to cut through becomes very scarred and kind of like hyperexcitable, right? So what I usually use for that is Botox, right? Because you can go right along the side of the craniotomy scar into the muscle directly where it is if that's your problem, and kind of help right along where the problem is. Now, that relies on a couple of things, right? You've had the proper scans to make sure it's not a tumor, and you've had the proper history and physical to make sure that it's not something else, right? But that's a very common problem with craniotomies.
And what is a craniotomy, doctor?
Craniotomy is the entry site for the neurosurgeon, right? They cut a hole in the bone, right? But to get to the bone, they have to cut through everything
In
your head, right? So it sounds like
Martin.
It sounds like Martin had bleeding, and they went in to evacuate it, so they had to cut through the skull to get the blood out, and then afterwards he subsequently developed headaches.
Gotcha. Martin, anything else?
No, thanks a lot.
Thanks, yeah, no Martin. Problem. Bye-bye. Okay, let's go to Susan in Red Hook. Susan, you're on.
Thank you. Hi, I wanted to ask the doctor about a problem that my daughter began to have at the beginning of January, which was a convergence problem. It was pretty severe, but...
Now, when you say problem, you mean she couldn't converge? She couldn't look down at her nose? Gotcha.
Yes, exactly. She went to see a neuro-oncologist at Yale, and she does have an atrophy of the optic nerve that she's had since she was 3 years old, probably since birth. And he said that he didn't know what the cause of it was, and he was surprised from what it looked like that she could see at all. And I was thinking, she thought it the only thing that had happened around the time that this began was she had gone to the chiropractor to be treated for C1 and C2 because of her neck, he said, had a reverse whiplash. And she was thinking it was that because of being C1 and C2. But in fact, she had had a concussion a year before. She fell off a horse onto her face. And I was wondering if the effects of the concussion could have been delayed almost a year. What does the doctor think about
that? You mean the eye movement abnormalities or the optic nerve atrophy?
Well, the optic nerve atrophy, as far as we know, is congenital.
Right. That's what I was going to say. That's probably not related. But you can have delayed effects. And how old did you say your child was?
She's 45.
Oh, never mind. So I was going to say, because in kids, you can have delay when they kind of grow into the problem, right? But in adults, you know, concussion is what's called a monophasic illness, right? Meaning that if there's an event and then there's problems after, and everything should kind of get better provided that you're on the, you know, you're getting treatments for each individual problem. So I wouldn't guess that this convergence insufficiency developed because of that so far out, but maybe it was there all along. It just wasn't recognized. That's a possibility too. Although, like I said, you can never say never, right?
Well, her vision deteriorated about the end of December.
So that's probably not related to the convergence insufficiency, unless it's what we call dynamic, right? So the convergence insufficiency at rest, she should be able to look straight ahead, and her acuity or her ability to see the Snellen eye chart should be unaffected by the convergence insufficiency. And convergence insufficiency is just something people can develop as they get older as well. It doesn't have to be from a concussion. So there's that too.
Susan, gotta let you go. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much for calling. Another phone call to me and saying, Dr. Shartok, I wanted more time. I'm sorry. You know, it's just the way I am.
Right.
Okay. We got a whole bunch of emails. Let's see if we can do them real fast.
Sure.
Can migraines be treated by weather events?
You know, there's a treated. You mean like affected? They can be provoked.
Can they be brought on?
Yeah. There's a lot of people who say that, and so enough people say it, I believe it. The question is, why does that happen? I have no idea.
Can migraines cause permanent, if slight, memory loss or other long-term information processing issues?
It's not. There's no real evidence that migraine itself, without causing damage on the MRI, can do that. Migraine is mainly a pain phenomenon, and so any memory problems you have should be related to something else. There are migraine-like mimics, which, you know, needs to be worked out by a neurologist as to whether or not you are a mimic or you are a true migraine. But the answer is, in general, no.
Okay. Let's see here. We had a call or an email. I was married to a man who had fairly regular moderate migraines. During the time we were married, I began to have them too, but not to the same degree of frequency. Never had them before or after marriage. Okay. So after making obvious joke, please comment if this is common or uncommon in couples.
I won't make any jokes about it because people in relationships have enough difficulty anyways, right? So, but as far as I know, migraine's not transmittable, right? The real question is were you both doing something together that could cause migraine, right? So a common migraine trigger are the muscles in the back of your neck, you know, and those can be triggered by arthritis and all hosts of things, right? So whether or not you guys were doing something together as a couple that might trigger it, it's possible, right? And, you know, like I mentioned before, you can have kind of this latent migraine-type problem and not really have any, you know, actual pain or headaches until one day you just develop a headache and you've kind of had this predisposition all along and never really knew it. So there's a possibility. Also, I don't know what the characteristics were. Maybe it wasn't a migraine at all. Maybe it was tension headache, which would be much more common in this case.
Okay, so here's another one. I'm 22 and I sleep on an average of 10 hours a day, to which I say, lucky you.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's a bit too much. I also trend to sleep most of the day when I have a cluster headache, which happens about 3 times a week. Is sleep related to migraines and to headaches?
It really depends on when the sleep happens, right? So there's this thing, there's this phenomenon in migraine called the predrome and the prodrome, right? So some people can feel leading up to it, they feel kind of funny. It can last like 24 to 40 hours. And then afterwards, this is kind of like letdown effect of I feel exhausted, right? So if it's related to those particular phases, then maybe, you know, some people, if you know, just sleep longer and shorter. You know, they're still working out in sleep research, you know, whether sleep is a genetic thing and how long people need and all and those types of things. So as far as I know, there's not anything detrimental unless it's causing you problems in your normal life.
Speaking of which, from Dan, was laughed out of a neurosurgeon's office after sharing that cluster headache sufferers had found relief with a non-recreational dose of magic mushrooms. He said they just wanted to get high, and I said rather be high on mushrooms than bent over a toilet and forced to be in a darkened room all day. Why are we so afraid of psychedelics? Thanks from Dan.
Yeah, so first of all, the neurosurgeon's office is not the place to be seeing for your cluster headaches. And, you know, just because...
That is not... The surgeon is the cutter.
Right. And, surgeons, they mainly deal with things with, you know, you need an imaging picture of an abnormality that they can fix with the scalpel, right? So, you know, if you're just having pain, right, you know, recurrent pain syndromes, that's not really the place to go. So that's not really... You probably didn't know that in the beginning, but just, you know, you kind of have this sensitivity to why I was laughed out. And the other part is, you know, mainstream medicine is not going to be acceptable of kind of alternative treatments for that. It's just now coming on board with things like medical marijuana for specific treatments. And, you know, anything more aggressive or less mainstream is just not going to be even evaluated by or taken into consideration by any of us because there's no evidence behind it. So that's the reason that the medical world doesn't really talk about these things. There's just no evidence yet.
Gotcha. Let's go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn, it's got to be real fast. What do you got?
Yes. A neurologist tested me once and told me that I was using both sides of my brain and that each side of my brain was also doing the work that's normally done by the other side of the brain. Can you explain to me what he was talking about? This was at Yale.
Yeah, sorry, I have no idea. But I would assume that because he works at Yale that he must have known what he was talking about. The only thing I can say is that most of what was thought to be on one side of the brain or the other is actually represented in both hemispheres, right? So when they do these functional MRIs and figure out actually where the metabolism is, you know, they thought at one time, oh, most people are left brain dominant, and they said that that's because where your speech is, but what they found now is actually speech is on both sides. And so I would assume that at all times you're using both parts of your brain, and the old, you know, folklore that you're only using 25% of your brain has been found not to be true. I think it's something like 75% of your brain is dedicated to eye movement and interpretation of visual stimuli. So as far as I know, you're using your whole brain at the same time all the time.
And that's why people who have brain damage can often recover some things, because the part that's damaged, those functions can be relearned and taken over by other parts of the brain.
Correct. There's redundancy of tracks, right? There's lots of the brain that do the same thing. And so, you know, sometimes you can loosely use the term workaround, right? The most obvious example of this is strokes, right? You have this area of damage, and then people start to recover, right? But that area is always that damaged area is always there, and it comes back from time to time in the setting of new stressors. So the stroke victim whose arm seems to be totally intact when he gets a urinary tract infection or the flu or something, then the arm weakness will come back, indicating that the damage is still there, but the compensation mechanisms have failed.
Interesting.
Okay.
Carolyn, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Bye.
We'll go to Evan in Red Hook. Okay, Evan, you're on, and it's got to be fast. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. I
just called about a pediatric population with concussions. Is there any current clinical guidelines or recommendations that you would that you know of at early on, 2 weeks into a concussion, where other than just brain rest and avoiding re-injuring, you want to start doing something else, whether it's rehab or something to mitigate the potential for
re-injury?
Not necessarily re-injury, but whether, like you were mentioning before, inflammatory mediators,
sure,
whether there's any vascular injuries that to just prevent poor wound healing or poor scar development, which would be avoidable.
Sure. So there's pretty specific return to play and return to learn guidelines. And usually the, you know, a local concussion person or a physical therapist will kind of know all about this stuff. In the general, you know, it used to be the cocoon therapy. People used to say, oh, you know, sit in a dark room and do nothing, right? But what they found is that when people came out of that cocoon, they were the exact same as when they went in, meaning they hadn't accustomated to any of the problems and relearned any, compensated for any of the new problems that they have. So kind of the general philosophy these days is, well, you want to try and rest whatever is most symptomatic, right? So if your son or daughter was extremely dizzy all the time, then sitting in a car would provoke a lot of the dizziness. So you would want to rest that until that provocation kind of goes away, and then you start to relearn and retrain. And usually people follow the return to learn and the return to play guidelines. And the most of the treatments surrounding those things are meant to eliminate the symptoms and get them out of the way so that people can kind of just get better on their own.
I'm so sorry, Evan. We are out of time, and I want to apologize to Monica from Stockbridge because we're not going to be able to help her with her question today. I want to thank Dr. Richard Jackson for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/Vox Pop. Stay tuned for a news update. But before we go, I want to mention that we're getting very, very, very close in the lockbox. So if you can do something now, it would be great. We are just inches and dots and dashes away from making it. Please put something in WAMC.org.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9